Tonight's edition of the Perpetual Notion Machine is pre-recorded, and it was recorded before Hurricane Helene hit home in the southeastern part of the country.
Good evening and welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine Show. My name is Andy Lamia and I am one of your hosts for this week. I am joined here today by Allison Jacoby and Ben Conkle, two UW-Madison students studying meteorology alongside myself. Today we would love to cover the topic of hurricanes and weather in the tropics. Ben, you want to get us started on the formation of hurricanes here?
Yeah, so basically a hurricane an Atlantic one at least, the ones that would affect us. Basically, it starts a series of thunderstorms in the tropics, usually in the eastern Atlantic, but it can also start in the western Atlantic or Caribbean. It essentially is there's these winds that are in the tropics that'll just push it westward. So it'll get pushed towards North America. And at this point, really the whole time, you're getting warm water around there. Though it depends, because if you have a time where you have warm water put together with the wind as you move miles and miles into the air, it's going pretty much the same direction, a storm can just gather and just keep building on top of itself. And eventually, if you get enough of this, it will start spinning effectively. It will develop a core that has a very low pressure, so that will suck in a lot of the air around it. And you will just get the air in the center just rise, put out all its moisture just for dozens and later could be even hundreds of miles.
And Ben hit it briefly there, but I wanted to stress again how important it is that we do study all these complex variables that go into storm formation. Creating these hurricanes is a result of complex interactions between dynamic and thermodynamic processes that occurs across a large, large space on many levels. And all these variables, like you need the moist, warm core development, you need energy transfers and transformations, atmospheric instability, radiative processes, and we need so many more variables on top of this to understand the formation and the intensification of these hurricanes. It's important to know the understanding of these hurricanes so that we can develop a safe procedure to warn people and to create predictions so we can warn for the next hurricane formation.
And because there are so many factors that go into the development and the creation of a hurricane, there has to be really complex tools that can actually take all of these large measurements.
Yes, exactly. There's a lot that goes into these measurements. Something that I use every day that I feel like is a good example is NOAA's weather maps on their website. You can see precipitation, wind speed. You can see if there's going to be a storm in your area at all. But into these weather maps, there's a multitude of other measurements, from radar and satellite observations to in-situ measurements and numerical model simulations to even buoys in our oceans that are measuring our weather. There's a lot that plays into these factors that play into these hurricanes, and it's necessary to be able to understand and predict and give out warnings if necessary for these major storms.
Yeah, and we have been experiencing and documenting hurricanes for so many years now, and even scientists now still don't really know everything. So kind of what we're going to go over today is more on the technical side and how thermodynamics play a part in the formation of tropical cyclones, in their intensity. So Ben, that leads us into your topic. Do you want to kind of lead us into how heat engines play a part?
Yeah, sure. So the main thing that is driving a hurricane is its heat engines. We see heat engines everywhere in life. For example, a diesel engine, jet airplane, they both use heat engines. You're essentially just using air or water, and you're heating it up and cooling it down in a manner that it will push something. So a heat engine requires a hot section, that's where your main energy will come from, and a cold section, because the heat has to be pushed and move somewhere. You need a cold section because hot tries to go towards cold. So essentially, in a hurricane, the main thing you're seeing is, so you have all this hot air that has a lot of moisture, and hot air rises. But as air rises, it cools. These are called adiabats. When you have moist air, like in this case, they'll generally cool at 6 degrees Celsius per kilometer. So a good bit, because you're going up like 10 miles into the air in some cases. So it'll get really cold up there. Estimates I saw, according to Thermodynamics of Hurricanes Revisited, say that it will get up to negative 55 degrees Celsius, which goes about to negative 67 degrees Fahrenheit. And basically what you're saying is that you have really cold air up here that'll get rise, and then you'll have very warm air towards the surface. It needs to be about 85 degrees, the ocean water, and the ocean and the air will probably be pretty similar temperatures, or the air will be hotter. And you're getting a really big difference. And this big difference is going to be what fuels the heat engine, because a heat engine requires a large difference for it to be most effective. So the main thing that happens in a heat engine is that first you have warm air. You have warm air, and it will push upwards on something. It will apply this force and just move stuff around it. So since you have all of this air leaving the center of the hurricane, there's a low pressure in the middle just because there's not that much air there. There's just not enough stuff. But the stuff that comes in, it keeps rising because it's very warm. Then at the top, you have it rise very quickly, go very high, get very cold. But it'll kind of just pile up there. Some of it will go outward, and this is really effective at keeping the air that gets warm and goes towards the center of the hurricane on the surface from just going up there because there's already stuff there. But this hurricane it'll kind of pile up. So you have a high pressure at the very top of like the troposphere, and you have a low pressure at the bottom for most of the core. So when you have this low pressure, some of this really cold air will start to sink, and you have this cold air sinking. It is warmed by the latent heat, which is heat released from air when the water vapor within it condenses. And following this, you have this, the energy like, oh no, there's some cold air coming in here. We need to get that back up. So it knocks that air back up. It keeps sucking in air. It keeps coming back down. So basically you have this column of warm air. So it starts by going all up, compresses, gets even hotter because according to the ideal gas law, if temperature remains constant and volume decreases, pressure must increase. So therefore you have this sinking and you have hot air just flood in from the surface, and the pressure once again increases, and it will just push upwards,
creating the cycle.
Well,
in simple terms, how can just this warm water and warm air turn into these huge storms that level major cities that are hundreds of miles across?
Well, in simple terms, you just have air rise, air get cold, air fall down, warm air comes in, and it just happens and happens again. And that air rises, it moves a lot. That's how you get all that wind spinning around everywhere. And because this air has moisture in it, it's just forming all these clouds. So you're just constantly forming these really huge clouds.
Yeah, because you can have all of those perfect conditions lining up, but if you don't have a strong fuel source and all that convection and condensation at those high altitudes, you're not going to have anything to organize at all.
I think what Ben was saying is that there's a bunch of variables that go into making these huge storms. And the first thing he mentioned was energy. And the atmosphere and the oceans are crucial in distributing this energy across the globe from areas of high pressure to low pressure, from areas of warm air that are being centered and absorbed at the tropics. They're moving poleward. But this distribution of energy affects global climate patterns through heat transfer and dissipation.
Yeah, heat transfer is very important because you have all the solar radiation coming into the tropics, but you don't have a lot coming to the poles. And because that life could not essentially exist without heat transfer, the heat's got to move around somehow because everything naturally wants to be balanced. So the main way to get it to the north is in the tropics, it's by these oceans just pushing up warm air, but that won't get past Florida. For the U.S., it's mainly these huge storm systems called mid-latitude cyclones. There'll be those big days where you have some severe weather alerts and you see a video of, oh, here's a tornado in Kentucky, and it'll also be raining because of the same thing here in Madison.
Can we accredit some of these storms to like an unbalance of energy or heat and cold?
Oh, yeah, that's the whole thing. The whole way they start is, it's a heat engine again. A heat engine needs hot area and a cold area, and then stuff will start moving. So that's just the whole basis for all this imbalance starting.
Another digestible way to kind of look at how that can cause motion, for those of you who have ever heard of the sea breeze that you often see on peninsulas or along the coast, what a lot of what's happening down there is the warmer areas, warm air rises, it's more buoyant. So as that air rises, something has to take its place. So that all that cold air that is moving further closer to the surface, lower to the ground, that's going to take its place, and that gives you that motion. So then when you have that on a large scale, it's not just warm and cold air at that point. You've got warm and cold air with places to go. And then once that starts organizing, you get these really advanced heat engines, which is what Ben was talking about. So that's a really cool way to look at it.
I think it's also cool how that kind of example shows how resilient and self-regulating our planet is, which is it's constantly redistributing this energy to keep systems in harmony, always working to maintain balance, you know? However, scientists predict that by the end of the century, tropical regions will experience dangerously high levels of heat stress due to rising global temperatures and atmospheric changes, which, coming off of Ben's points here, that's going to result in more hurricanes, more extreme weather down in the tropics there.
Yeah, I'd like to add on to that too. From what I have seen according to studies, I'm not sure if more hurricanes exactly will happen because there's a variety of factors in a storm like hurricanes, but they will get stronger than they have been in the past. We're already seeing that with rapid intensification almost becoming the norm.
Yeah, like this year, I believe NOAA had put out a really aggressive prediction for not just the amount of storms, but the intensity. And they did have a pretty high amount of storms this year. I don't recall exactly the number, but Beryl was almost, I think, record-breaking for how fast it intensified from a Category 1 to within 9 to 10 hours was already a Cat 4 and a Cat 5. So that's definitely something that's piquing scientists' interest right now, that's becoming a growing issue.
Can you tell us, Allison, how severe these Cat 4 and Cat 5 hurricanes are?
Yeah, so I've never seen one myself. I've only been in tropical storms. But for just a Category 1, you're already getting 74 to 95 miles an hour. And mind you, that's sustained wind speeds. And once you get into Category 4 and 5, you're reaching almost tornadic levels of wind, over 160 miles an hour or greater, sustained wind speeds at landfall. So that's when the eye of the storm moves over land. The highest wind speeds are going to be wrapped around that eye wall. That does billions of dollars worth of damage if they hit large populations.
I mean, yeah, a couple weeks ago there was Francine, and I mean, it came landfall as it just crossed the Category 2 threshold, and 400 people like lost power. I mean, you gotta think, oh, you see 74 mile an hour winds, that's a big deal on its own, but everywhere in maybe a state.
Yeah, so within just a front, you can already see some vorticity happen and spinning up some tornadoes or supercells and strong wind speeds that are coming from thunderstorms. But a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the South's tornadoes can also come from tropical storms. Florida, especially, most of their tornadoes are from tropical storms and low-level hurricanes washing over. And in those really intense wind speeds and the rain bands, they will see a lot of tornadoes form, which there were a couple over the summer in Central Florida when Beryl went through and even when Tropical Storm Debbie went through.
We talk about hurricanes and we talk about large storms, but why doesn't every large storm turn into a hurricane?
So that's one thing that scientists are still looking into because it's such a strange phenomena. And if you have noticed, we don't have the most perfect prediction for it yet. A lot of people will see news outlets saying there might be a hurricane coming and then they won't see anything for days. So a lot of what makes up hurricanes is conditions just lining up perfectly. You've got to have a fuel source with all that warm water that can create those powerful heat engines. You can't have too many obstructions in the air, say the Saharan dust coming off of Africa. This year, that has been a really big stopping factor for a lot of the tropical weather that was predicted in late July and early August. Another one is wind shear. So you have really strong winds at high altitudes, and as those directions change, they can kind of mess up with the organization of a couple little sad little thunderstorms that are trying to organize and gain some rotation. They just get blasted apart. Another thing is also El Nino and La Nina. If you have a El Nino season, you may have some stronger winds that keep the tropic season a little bit more tame. While this year, with that switch to La Nina, we don't have as much wind shear, which is why we're getting a ton more powerful storms coming in and why NOAA had such an aggressive prediction. Another phenomena that's really common in the Atlantic is a monsoonal trough. Disorganized areas of showers where there can be little kinks of lower pressure forming between 5 and 30 degrees north or south latitudes. So one big cause of these disturbances gaining power and eventually forming into an invest and then a tropical storm comes from these monsoonal troughs. Now, overall, in the past 5 to 10 years, there has been a lot of advancements made, especially with the technology that's used to kind of identify what these causes are to make our forecasting products better. And from 2014 to 2019, there were especially a lot of advancements in looking at external processes as well as some internal ones. So those external processes may be something called Madden-Julian oscillation. So what that is a global scale atmospheric disturbance. You have a lot of hot water further west generating all of that condensation and strong storms over there. And a lot of the energy from that kind of gets pushed over to the east and will drop the pressure in other areas in the Atlantic Ocean, which can kind of be a focal point to drive that formation from some disorganized showers and storms out in the mid-Atlantic.
How much role does atmospheric moisture play in worsening heat stress in the tropics or making the storms worse?
Yeah, so that kind of goes along with what the fuel is for tropical systems, because if you have a lot of dry air going in there, you don't have very much to condense with. You're not going to build those really powerful towering cumulus clouds if most of that air is relatively dry and you don't have that moisture.
Yeah, not enough fuel, right?
Yeah, so a lot of the moisture, it's just fuel. So all of that moisture is what creates those towering cumulus clouds that can then organize into strong tropical systems. Another kind of unexpected thing you may see in the tropics too is you need weak areas as well to create these perfect monsters. What people may not expect is you'd think that you would just want an area of some really powerful fuel, really warm waters, warm temperatures, the perfect winds, but you do have to have some of those more imperfect conditions as well, which we refer to as stability and instability. So another thing that is really common and that a lot of studies have actually found is essential for tropical storm formation is radial gradients. So as you get further and further away from the center of circulation of a tropical system or something that's beginning to organize, you need to have those weaker areas as well as the strong ones. Because again, kind of like how heat engines work, all of the weak areas are going to drive into the strong areas, which is what gives you vorticity. So if you have just a region of just high energy, what's stopping it from just condensing and moving upwards, not into a center to drive vorticity? So if you were to just have a weak area, it's vice versa. You'd have that sinking air or air not rising fast enough. So you have to have a strong center and weak outer bounds to drive into the center to give that rotation interacts with the Coriolis force naturally generated by the Earth's spin, which can then form those really precise and powerful circulations you get in a tropical storm or hurricane.
While the focus is on tropical heat stress, why do us in cold Midwest Wisconsin care?
Well, for one, sometimes these tropical storms can actually reach Wisconsin. One of the most infamous hurricanes in American history, the Great Galveston Hurricane in 1900, which destroyed the city and responsible for Houston becoming the primary city on the Gulf, actually got up to Wisconsin and caused some effects there. But that was a long time ago. Just in 2020, the remnants of Tropical Storm Cristobal actually managed to reach Wisconsin. They had caused wind gusts of 51 miles an hour recorded at Fond du Lac Airport. And there was also rain that reached more than 3 inches that was near Augusta.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of people may not realize, but when you think of all these hurricanes and tropical storms hitting the south, where does it go? And a lot of the rain we may get right after those is from the remnants of those storms, because those storms will head up into the U.S. And then with all that friction of it going over the ground, they start to dissipate and then get blasted away by all those cold fronts that wash through the middle of the U.S. So Wisconsin does see some of the remnants of the moisture and the winds coming from the south. Although we don't experience it quite like they do, we still get a taste of it.
I was actually about to add on with that, with how these hurricanes can change weather patterns in Wisconsin and increase our summer heat and humidity, potentially becoming a local concern. And even up here in Wisconsin, we love our cold weather.
Yeah, just following up on that, one of the main way you would get heat that goes from the tropics to like the middle latitudes, you know, the U.S. and all that, is just through storm systems. So like when you get a hurricane get us here, that energy is now here. That's going to be here going around this part of the earth for, you know, this time period. So that's a very big deal. That will, you know, have some effects, because a hurricane can have the energy of 10,000 nuclear bombs. So,
which is just insane to think about.
In good news, Wisconsin as a hub for agricultural innovation and sustainable energy research could play a vital role in global climate solutions.
So we've been talking a lot about the tropics, but what makes it so important to us all the way up here in old cold Wisconsin?
Well, the tropics are very important to weather, and tropical regions are often the birthplace of extreme weather events like hurricanes, like we were talking about, due to the vast amounts of energy stored in the warm ocean waters in that area. Atmospheric thermodynamics helps explain how energy is transferred from the ocean to the atmosphere, fueling these storms. For instance, when warm air, moist air rises, it cools and condenses, like Ben was saying earlier, and that releases latent heat, which intensifies these storm systems, acting kind of like a fuel system. This warm water leads to stronger, more frequent storms, and this kind of links back to global climates and how we're being affected all the way up here in Wisconsin by hurricanes, even though the hurricanes are taking place all the way down by the equator.
Awesome. So how do scientists come to learn this new information? Have there been advancements in their ways of measuring hurricanes? Or
yeah, so one of the biggest ways that we are studying all this right now is observations all over the world. We have buoys out in the waters that are constantly taking measurements. We're releasing drop sondes and radio sondes twice a day, every day, in thousands of locations across the world. And all of that is funneling information into computer models. So most continents and countries actually have their own models. And as time goes on, and as we're putting in more and more data across the years, those computers are getting even better at predicting what may happen. So what scientists are doing is they're running simulations that are starting to get better at predicting what may happen, especially in the tropics, as well as over the mid-US, over Wisconsin, and pretty much anywhere across the globe. Other tools that we've been using for a long time are satellites. There are a lot of satellites orbiting the Earth that are constantly giving us data. And now newer satellites, like all those Starlink launches that have been going on recently, have really increased our ability to monitor what is happening in the Earth and constantly take measurements that are fueling those numerical products to get better and better and better at forecasting. So you don't have to look at your phone, see a forecast for the next couple of days, and constantly doubt what it's actually going to be outside. They're getting so much better as time progresses. So while all of this talk of the tropics does give us some warmer and maybe wetter weather up here, it can be really disastrous for especially those communities that are getting hit really hard. Florida especially, they're in an insurance crisis because insurance companies don't make money down there. And with all of this weather starting to get more and more intense and more frequent, the economical implications are just going to continue getting worse. The damage from severe weather has only been increasing. The number of billion-dollar disasters each year has been increasing as well. And the years it takes for a lot of these communities to finally recover from these disasters takes years. Some haven't even fully recovered yet from hurricanes just in the past decade.
But yeah, no, exactly. Like, take, for example, Hurricane Harvey, which ravaged Houston in 2017. Now, according to a study done by the University of Houston based on Harvey recovery, this was in 2022, 18.4% of residents had not mostly or fully recovered from Hurricane Harvey. And I mean, 5 years later, looking at the time, like, oh, that's big. But then you look at some more of the details. Like, for example, 8.5% of people they surveyed lost their job as a result of Hurricane Harvey. So no matter what situation, you lose your job, that's a big life-changing thing. You have to make a lot of new decisions. Maybe go move somewhere or something. So while a lot of effort going into Harvey about helping people rebuilding, they were very good with that, there's still a lot of shortcomings, even in a place like Houston.
And before we wrap up here, too, I did want to stress, like, the importance of studying a field like this. Studying storms of this magnitude can help in overall preparedness, from warning people ahead of time to get out of their homes to warning communities what the overall magnitude of this storm is going to be like, so people can get out, people can be safe. And especially with, like we said earlier in the show, that these storms can be highly unpredictable. We have no way of telling what the exact magnitude of these storms are always going to be like.
Yeah, and right now, most of our meteorologists and scientists working in atmospheric science know about 36 and even between 96 hours out from when a tropical feature may develop into a tropical storm or hurricane. So we know the timeline, but what we don't know is the intensity. So that far out, if our models are able to take a look at the conditions, accurately predict what the future conditions will be, that can then accurately predict what the intensity of the storm may be, we may be able to have a much better warning system for what to expect from the storm, not just when the storm will arrive.
Which is going to help reduce economic impacts. It's going to help provide resources to those in need. It's going to help insurance companies prepare for the storm that's coming. It's going to help every aspect from economic to social to environmental.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Andy. And advancements in this area are immeasurably impactful for those that are affected by hurricanes and tropical storms every single year. And in 2023, over 2.5 million Americans were displaced from their homes, either from hurricanes or tornadoes born from hurricanes. So the more knowledge that we have on the intensity of these storms, the timeline of these storms, and even an idea of what the season is going to look like for when these storms may hit, the more lives and livelihoods that stand to be saved. And the good news is that all of these advancements we've been making have been only picking up as we learn more and more each year and have better preparedness strategies along with better prediction models. It seems that our emergency preparedness strategies are only going to get better.
All this science talk here reminded me of an important event coming up, which we'll hit here as we wrap up. The Wisconsin Science Festival is an exciting statewide celebration of science held annually. The festival features a wide variety of events such as hands-on activities, science talks, demonstrations, and exhibits, making science accessible to people of all ages. It's designed to spark curiosity and inspire lifelong learning in STEM fields. This year, the festival takes place from October 16th to the 22nd of 2024, with events happening across Wisconsin, including at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This festival offers an excellent opportunity for students, families, and science enthusiasts to engage with cutting-edge research and learn from experts in the field. For more information, check out the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's STEM Inspire program. Again, that's the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's STEM Inspire program page. Ben, Allie, am I going to see you at the Wisconsin Science Festival?
Oh, you definitely will. That sounds exciting.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a really great activity. I'll definitely see you there.
Well, thank you, Ben and Allie, so much for joining me on the Perpetual Notion Machine show, and same for the audience, and sharing your insights on the mid-tropic weather. Again, that was Allison Jacoby and Ben Conkle, meteorology students here at UW-Madison. And that does it for the show tonight, hopefully helping you all know a little more about hurricanes and weather in the tropics. Be on the lookout for more information regarding Wisconsin Science Festival, either on the UW-Milwaukee's website or hopefully in future WART shows here. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope to see you all next week.